This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Syrian forces go after Islamic State fighters in Palmyra. An internet scam demanding ransom makes trouble. Humanitarian groups make their way through earthquake-ravaged Nepal.
We learn over and over and over again that people who are affected by these disasters know best what they need and how they want to be helped.
A Grammy-winning group takes aim at Bulletproof Picasso. These and other stories just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. Turkey's foreign minister says his government has agreed in principle with the United States to provide air protection to Syrian rebels being trained to fight Islamic State militants in Syria. A U.S. defense official told VOA Monday that Washington was in ongoing discussions with Ankara, but that no decisions have been made. Ankara is reluctant to send any military power across its borders in a conflict. Meanwhile, activists say Syrian government forces carried out at least 15 airstrikes on Monday, targeting Islamic State fighters in the central city of Palmyra. VOA's Jeffrey Young spoke with Colin Clark, associate political scientist at the RAND Corporation Pittsburgh, about the difficulties in cutting revenue streams funding Islamic State and the financial importance of holding Palmyra.
It's clearly a very strategic move on the part of ISIS. This is a group that's continued to diversify its funding portfolio and develop a fairly robust resource base. It smuggles and traffics oil and looted antiquities, which is what Palmyra will be used for, as well as the continued extortion and protection payments that ISIS extracts from the population in the areas under its control, kidnapping for ransom, looting of state-owned banks. So clearly, this is a group that is prepared to adapt.
The global financial system has been largely locked down to them, or has it? How are they able to pay their salaries, pay for things?
Yeah, great question. As far as we know, the money is largely stayed out of the international financial market. Certainly banks, correspondent banks, and even larger banks are on the lookout for that. But what we know about ISIS that differentiates it from previous terrorist groups is that the bulk of its funding is raised and spent locally. And so cash does change hands, but it doesn't necessarily have to cross international borders, although it does on a more regional basis with money flowing back and forth between Syria and Iraq and up into Turkey as well.
The airstrikes that have been conducted against the Islamic State, some of them have been focused specifically on refineries and pipelines that try to cut that revenue stream. Has the United States and its coalition partners been successful in disrupting their financial inflows?
Yeah, I think that the airstrikes actually have been effective in curtailing some of ISIS's revenue that the group has gained through the smuggling and trafficking of oil. But like I just mentioned, the group has a diverse funding portfolio, so when the oil revenues run low, the group simply switches to more reliance on looting state-owned banks in Iraq and extortion and taxation in the areas under its control. And so what I'd like to just point out here is the critical importance of the control of territory. Because with control of the territory, ISIS can then tax the people who live under its control. And furthermore, these people are a bit more willing to part with their money because ISIS is providing all the trappings of governance.
Is there any straightforward solution for chopping off their revenue?
It's a combination of kinetic and non-kinetic activities. It's continued targeting of the mobile oil refineries, but it's also continuing to beef up border security. I think right now we're somewhat confounded because we haven't seen a group with so many different ways to make money. And the fact that the money is locally raised and locally spent means that we're more reliant than ever on local security forces, which, as we've seen, haven't really been up to snuff.
Colin Clark is associate political scientist at the RAND Corporation in Pittsburgh. I'm Jeffrey Young, VOA News.
U.S. Vice President Joe Biden telephoned Iraq's Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi Monday to thank Iraqi forces for their enormous sacrifice and bravery against Islamic State militants. The call was apparently aimed at soothing Iraqi anger after U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter said Sunday that Iraqi forces retreated from Ramadi last week because they have no will to fight, allowing Islamic State to take over the city. In an interview with the BBC Monday, Prime Minister Abadi described the defense chief's remarks as misguided and promised Ramadi would be retaken in days, not weeks. The White House says Vice President Biden reaffirmed full U.S. support for Iraq's fight against Islamic State, including plans to speed up training and equipping Iraqi forces. Our audience has been busy commenting on these developments at voanews.com. Theodore Frimmett from Pennsylvania, USA, says Iraq's Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi is correct in his assessment of winning a war against ISIS. His borders are secure and need only the advice of his armed forces. Tactical border incursions would be acceptable. Now is the time to preempt the return of ISIS, as they will no doubt turn their attention to the Iranian border, inevitable, as Iraq will regain Ramadi and all of their country and push ISIS south. You, too, can send us your comments at voanews.com. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. A U.S. law allowing the National Security Agency to collect bulk data from domestic telephone users is set to expire on June 1st. Last week, the U.S. Senate failed to pass a resolution to keep the controversial surveillance program going. VOA's Michael Bowman covers the Senate on Capitol Hill. He spoke with VOA's Jim Stevenson about what led up to the congressional stalemate.
Congress left town, but not before displaying that having the Republicans in control of both chambers is no guarantee that there will be agreement and action on something as important as how the United States handles national security in the post-9/11 era. The United States has a program where the National Security Agency collects the phone records of all Americans at all time, as was pointed out by Republican Senator Rand Paul, in a 10-hour, in 10 hours of uninterrupted speaking on the Senate floor.
Quite a display of oratory there.
Yes, and the second time he has done so in just the last 3 years. The first time was to draw attention to America's use of drones. Nevertheless, the Republican-led Senate voted on two bills and voted both of them down. The first would have taken phone records and kept them in the control of telephone companies, and the United States government could access those records via a court order. However, these records would be physically held by the telephone companies. And that's something that the Obama administration wants. That's something that the House of Representatives passed just 10 days ago, and it was thought that that was the best vehicle to resolve the issue. However, the Senate voted it down. Then the Senate voted on a 2-month extension of the existing program. This was considered a stopgap just to give Congress some more time to come up with a better and more permanent solution. But at about 1 in the morning on Saturday morning, the Senate voted that down as well. So the House had already left town. The Senate voted down two bills, including the one that was passed by the House. And so as a result, Congress has left town doing nothing on the NSA's bulk collection of telephone records. That program expires at midnight on June 1st. The Senate is and the House, they are both out this week. It is the Memorial Day recess. So Congress will be returning just as this law expires, and it is not clear what, if anything, can or will be done.
There was quite a bit of disagreement between parties, within parties, on what to do with this. And you could almost say that a non-vote by the Senate was almost a no-vote. Just let it expire.
Indeed. And there is some question as to the utility of this program. It has been pointed out that of the attacks that are believed to have been prevented, it's not clear that it has specifically led to the foiling of a plot. It's also not clear if this program were to expire, say, for a day or a week or even a month, and then Congress got around to taking it up again, whether that lapse would be critical in any way regarding national security.
Well, Mike Bowman routinely covers the Senate for us, the Voice of America. Michael, thank you, and your comments are now bulk data for the masses.
Excellent. Excellent.
Senate correspondent Michael Bowman speaking with VOA's Jim Stevenson. A computer nightmare. You sit down at your computer, go online, and a message pops up on your screen telling you all of your files have been taken, but you may get them back if you pay a specified amount of money. It doesn't happen often, but the cyber threat of ransomware seems to be growing. VOA Susan Yockey and cyber correspondent Doug Bernard discuss how hackers extort your personal information.
There's an old internet scam floating around that's getting some new attention lately. It's called ransomware. And if you're unlucky, it may have already infected your computer or mobile phone. Joining us now is VOA cyber correspondent Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's this all about anyway?
Well, Susan, recently the FBI issued a public warning for people in the United States, alerting them to a recent spread in ransomware. Now, ransomware is basically a bug, a bit of malware. These bugs have been around since at least the early 90s, so it's nothing new. But what we are seeing is a recent renewal in Japan, in Australia, in Western Europe. They really tend to be spreading very fast. So here's how it works. Basically, your computer is infected. Perhaps you click on a link that you shouldn't, or maybe you're not using antivirus or something like that. So a bug, a bit of malware, lands on your computer, and quietly it encrypts certain kinds of files on your computer. And these types of files are things that are traditionally called user-generated. So Word documents, spreadsheets, pictures, videos, that kind of thing. Things that you probably, that mean a lot to you. So when you go and try and access one of these files, you get a little pop-up, and the pop-up basically says, your files have been encrypted, we're holding them ransom, and until you pay us, say, maybe $300, you're not going to get them back.
Well, is this just a scam, or do you really get your files back?
Well, one analyst I spoke with says, you know, this is really a business of sorts. So in some ways, it's a scam. The bad guys are trying to extort money from you. But they want it also known that if indeed you pay them, say, $300 or something, that indeed they will give you that key and you will be able to unlock your files, because chances are, you'll mention that to somebody else. The word gets around that for a fee that's sort of troublesome, but, you know, $300. Maybe for some people that's troublesome and irritating, but, you know, worth it to get their important trusted files back.
But you have to trust a crook.
You do have to trust a crook. But again, if you're thinking that the crooks make their money from this, if it becomes known that they're just scamming you out of $300, then nobody's going to send them money anymore. But if it gets out there that indeed, you know, if you pay up, you'll get the key and you'll get your documents back. That's actually to the benefit of the bad guys.
Well, how do you protect yourself from this?
Well, once you're infected, unfortunately, there's basically nothing that you can do. These ransomware bugs use very strong encryption, encryption levels essentially that the NSA couldn't even break. So the thing that you need to do is mitigate to protect yourself in case that you are infected. That means back up your computer, back it up often, and back it up maybe to several different locations that aren't connected permanently to your computer, external drives. It's also just very important, again, to use a antivirus program. Symantec, Kaspersky, Norton, there's a bunch out there, and they are pretty good at sniffing out these bugs before they actually infect your computer.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Doug.
I hope you keep safe out there.
Thank you. That's VOA cyber correspondent Doug Bernard.
An update of the latest world news coming up and a look at Bulletproof Picasso. This is VOA's International Edition.
I'm Victor Beatty with the latest headlines. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden telephoned Iraq's Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi to thank Iraqi forces for their enormous sacrifice and bravery against Islamic State militants. It comes just after Sunday's comments publicly by Defense Secretary Ashton Carter, who said Iraqi forces retreated from Ramadi last week because they had no will to fight. In Burundi, more anti-government protests, including the capital Bujumbura, after the opposition quit UN-brokered peace talks following the killing of a prominent opposition leader and his bodyguard Saturday. The United States condemned the killings and urged Burundian authorities to arrest the perpetrators and protect other politicians. Fuel wholesalers in Nigeria say they've reached an agreement with the government to resume fuel distribution, ending a crisis that brought airlines, banks, and telephone companies to a standstill. They had stopped distributing fuel, saying the government owed them $1 billion. Government officials said the wholesalers had been paid in full. That's the latest news. I'm Victor Beatty.
New strategies for relief to earthquake-ravaged Nepal coming up. Stay with us.
This is Greenbeat.
Plastic bags blowing across lawns, floating in waterways, and getting caught on vegetation are just some of the reasons more and more local governments are adding laws against their use, including in China's Jilin province, where this shopper lives.
I totally agree with the ban order. I'm willing to pay 1 or 2 won for each biodegradable plastic bag.
Here in the United States, one of the latest legislative moves is California's ban on plastic bags at retail outlets. The United States' first state law banning most plastic bags may be sidelined, however, if a petition against it is successful. That should make some dog owners happy. They often use the bags to heed Mother Nature's call. And with about 83 million owned dogs in the United States, that's a lot of bags. Fortunately, some enterprising entrepreneurs have stepped in to fill the void. Companies like Chicago-based PoopBags.com make biodegradable bags for dog owners. The baggy bans are but a boon to their business. For VOA's Green Beat, I'm Rebecca Ward.
A violent storm raged through a Mexican city along the U.S. border Monday, killing at least 11 people, injuring dozens more, and flattening hundreds of homes. To the north, flooding left at least 3 people dead and destroyed at least 400 homes in Texas and the neighboring state of Oklahoma. A line of storms stretched from the Gulf of Mexico far northward to the Great Lakes. 2 major earthquakes have struck Nepal since April 25th, killing and wounding thousands and leaving untold numbers of Nepalese homeless. Relatively little is known about how humanitarian groups assess the trauma and decide how and whom to help with funding and supplies. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with 2 representatives from American Jewish World Service, or AJWS, who are on the ground in rural Nepal, and asked them to explain their mission strategy and personal approach.
Despite its name, American Jewish World Service is not a religious organization. Rather, it expresses the Jewish values of compassion and justice to help non-Jews who are suffering around the world. Whether in Haiti in 2010, when a hurricane killed more than 100,000 people, or the Philippines, where Typhoon Haiyan claimed over 6,300 lives in 2013, or in West Africa during last year's Ebola epidemic. Samantha Walthus, AJWS's Director of Disaster Response, spoke with VOA earlier this month within Nepal's earthquake zone.
We learn over and over and over again that people who are affected by these disasters know best what they need and how they want to be helped. So what we try to do at AJWS is earn the respect of the communities. We go in, we sit with people, we talk to them, we listen to them, we hear their stories, we cry with them, we laugh with them, and then we get to the support part.
Knowing the cultural nuances of a place is key to fulfilling AJWS's mission. That's one reason why Walthus relies on Aaron Acharya as her cultural guide and translator in the Nepali villages on her itinerary. Acharya was born in Bhutan and spent some years as a political refugee in Nepal. Today, he lives in New York, where he helps administer AJWS's global projects.
These are the people who gave me refuge when I didn't have a home. And if I can support them in any way, interpreting for them so that other people can actually hear not only the words that they're saying, but also are hearing the emotions and the challenges and the culture and the traditions that come with the word, I'm giving something back.
AJWS's niche among NGOs is to attend to a society's most vulnerable and underserved populations. For example, TEWA, also called the Nepal Women's Fund, is a Kathmandu-based grassroots group dedicated to women's rights and maternal health. Waltha says that post-quake, TEWA has been sheltering pregnant mothers in tents and giving them food, blankets, medical care, and bottled water.
We've heard multiple stories about women that have had babies in these fields under these tents. And with AJWS's funds, they're also working to raise awareness in the camps about the risk of waterborne diseases and health epidemics that may arise and that we're helping to prevent before the monsoon really gets heavy here.
AJWS also funds Nepal's Blue Diamond Society, which works with Nepal's lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community.
They're doing a lot of work with the HIV positive community. You know, we've seen over and over again in disasters that it's very hard for individuals that have HIV or even AIDS who are reliant on the medicine to get that care after a disaster because, you know, all of the medical providers are focused on caring for folks that have been injured in the disaster. We saw this as well with Ebola in Liberia.
The Dalits of Nepal, who occupy the lowest rung in the country's ancient caste system, can also get left behind by government and government-apportioned NGO funding. So AJWS funds a Dalit-run group who is far more familiar with the community's challenges, which include discrimination, than either foreign NGOs or non-Dalit Nepalis.
We don't go in as AJWS and say we think we understand the dynamics and we want everyone to get along. That's not our role. We actually hire local people on the ground to be here to help them fill out the proposals, write the reports, and learn about their challenges and their successes. So it really is a collaborative effort.
Aaron Acharya says sometimes there's tension and rivalry between tribal and ethnic villages as they compete for foreign aid and relief.
So if you can bring like tents to this one village and you don't bring it to the other, it would probably translate as you are favoring this tribe over the other. So as a funder, being aware of those kind of tensions, those kind of nuances in a community, I think is very, very important.
One conflict avoidance strategy is to recruit a native Nepali who is not openly affiliated with AJWS or another NGO to come to a community alone on a motorbike and unobtrusively gather information.
And they try to figure out what's going on here, what's needed, who lives here, who are the leaders, what are the different tribes or ethnic groups that this village is made up. They try to collect all of that data without creating any kind of tension in the communities.
That's just one of the many balancing acts NGOs must perform while in country, in locales where suffering is great and the future is unsure. Samantha Walthus says American Jewish World Service strives to do the greatest good for the most people, efficiently, respectfully, and for the very long term. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
The Grammy Award-winning San Francisco-based band Train has a new album named Bulletproof Picasso. VOA Border Crossings host Larry London gave it a listen and talks about it with Bob Doty.
When I think about my problems and I truly understand, in a world like this, being a white man, I'm ashamed that I complain. I'm not sure that I know pain, but I know this.
Larry, we're talking about Train.
Yes,
Who's
we are.
Who's on the track?
Who's on the track? Well, Train's on the track. Train have a new album out, which is called Bulletproof Picasso. It's their seventh album since they began in 1993 together. Their first album, 1998, which was called Train, went platinum and had a huge hit for them, a song that was called Meet Virginia. And then several years later, in 2001, they put out another album which called Drops of Jupiter. The title track earned them two Grammy Awards that year.
Two Grammys. Wow.
And we were just listening to a song off the new album, Bulletproof Picasso. The song is called Give It All, which Pat Monahan, the lead singer of the band, says it kind of reminds him of the fact that May is Mental Health Awareness Month.
Oh, yeah.
And the song is very powerful. It has a message about loss and about healing and about letting go. So the band feel that this single is very timely for this particular month and what we're thinking about at this time.
So this is the latest current hit for them?
Yep, it's their new song, and it's, as I say, off the seventh album, Bulletproof Picasso, which for the band Train is kind of a little departure over the last couple of albums, because recently in the last few years they've released albums about their home San Francisco, California.
Right.
And so, like, the last album they had out was called California 37, which is the name of a highway in San Francisco that runs through San Francisco. So it's very interesting. They love San Francisco. They've just started a wine company. How many bands have their own wine?
I can't think of one of them.
You can't think
of,
well, no. Now there's Train. So you can add that to
but
your
list. But
they
can load up all their wines on the train.
That's it.
Oh, no. I didn't say that.
But, you know, some of their wines include the Save Me San Francisco Wine Company. They've released Drops of Jupiter, California Red. They've got, these are names of their songs, Soul Sister, Pinot. They've got California 37 Cabernet. So obviously they're playing off of some of the names of their songs or albums, which is kind
of
cool.
And now one of them is called Grapes of Wrath.
None of them. No Grapes of Wrath.
Well, maybe that'll be the next album. Now, they were formed in 1993 out of where you said San Francisco. They are an American rock band. That's quite a few years for them. They're still quite popular.
Yes, they are. In fact, they're on tour with The Fray right now, doing a world tour. And, I love Train's music, and I have for a number of years, and their music's appeared on TV shows and in film. And, in fact, recently Train performed at the Earth Day concert here in Washington, D.C.
Oh, yeah.
Which is where I had a chance to meet and speak with Pat Monahan, the lead singer of the band. When Train started, Pat revealed to me, when they first started, they were a Led Zeppelin cover band. They sang Led Zeppelin songs.
So that was some of their influence.
Yes, definitely.
Led Zeppelin from way back.
From way back when?
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Bob.
Larry London, our Border Crossings host, talking about the American rock band from San Francisco, Train. Don't worry about me.
This edition of International Edition. You can get more news and information at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is a Pacific nation, and as such has an enormous stake in the people and future of Southeast Asia. The region is home to some of our largest trading partners and buys many of our exports, supporting millions of American jobs. We need partnerships with the Philippines, Thailand, Indonesia, Singapore, and Vietnam, and other nations there to meet the challenges of growing our economy, preventing nuclear proliferation, and addressing climate change. The U.S. works constantly to strengthen old alliances there and deepen new ones. Toward that end, top U.S. officials met recently with their counterparts in the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, in the 28th in a series of annual dialogues aimed at reinforcing our strategic partnership with the region. Both parties reaffirmed their commitment to jointly realize solutions to pressing global, regional, and transnational issues affecting the region, including climate change, illegal, unregulated, and unreported fishing, humanitarian assistance and disaster relief, and recent developments in the South China Sea. The United States and ASEAN also discussed the migrant situation in Southeast Asia and the need to work expeditiously to save lives and to address the underlying challenges that contribute to the migration. The very productive discussions in the dialogue are a tangible demonstration of our commitment to the rebalance of U.S. foreign policy towards Asia.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.